what I wanted to do a little bit tonight is talk about the land of Israel, but I wanted to talk about a framework. And to do that, I want to focus on the thought of some of our great legacies, some of our great thinkers of the previous generation. I'm focusing a lot on Rav Soloveitchik. And of course, in order to provide this framework and to think about the land of Israel and the state of Israel in a way that's hopefully a little bit broader, a little bit different than we might otherwise think about it, we obviously have to start with the Rambam. Whenever we're going to delve into the thought of Rav Soloveitchik, so we have to start with the Rambam. And hopefully we'll see that this perspective that emerges is something that shapes the way we can think about Eretz Yisrael and Medinat Yisrael and the role that it plays throughout Jewish history and particularly in our day. So let's, if you will, please turn to the first source. We have a Rambam in a place that actually makes a good deal of sense when you want to talk about the land of Israel. So the Rambam here that we have in source number one is the Rambam in Hilchos Trumos. Right? We know that one of the beautiful aspects of the land of Israel is that we have many mitzvos that are specifically designed for the land of Israel and only for the land of Israel. So the Rambam in Hilchos Trumos, right, the mitzvah of bringing part of the produce that is grown specifically in Eretz Yisrael and giving it to the kahuna, to the kohen. So that is a mitzvah that is called one of the mitzvos hatzluyos v'aretz. And in the context of the mitzvah of truma, the Rambam gives us a little bit of a history lesson. So if you look at source number one, the Rambam tells us, kol shehechziku ole mitzrayim v'neskadesh kedusha rishona kevan shegalu batlu kedushasan. The Jewish people entered the land of Israel as a nation for the first time, right? We know that the Jewish people's claim to the land of Israel goes way, way back, right? But the first time the Jewish people entered the land of Israel as a nation was when? After Yetzias Mitzrayim. So the first generation that entered the land of Israel is referred to as the Olei Mitzrayim, right? The people who made Aliyah from the land of Egypt. So the Rambam tells us that when they entered, the land was endowed with a certain kedusha, a holiness. Now he says, now that holiness is a little bit funny, because that holiness, it didn't last forever. He said that holiness lasted as long as the Jewish people had sovereignty in the land, as long as they were there, that first generation that entered the land and stayed in that land until the first exile. So that land had a holiness that was endowed by that group of people in those generations. He says, Shekedusha, Rishon of the second line, Lefisha Haisa Mipnei HaKibush, because their Kedusha, the Kedusha of that land, resulted from the conquering of the land, which took place with Yehoshua and the generation that came out of the Midbar. So since it was a function of it, the land being conquered, Bilvad Kidsha L'Shaita, the Kedusha remained as long as they were there. V'lo Kidsha L'Asilavu, that Kedusha didn't last forever. Kaven Sha'alu B'nei HaGola, but, says the Rambam, don't worry, after the first exile, after the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed and the people were exiled for the first time, so they went into Golus, and then they returned. And that returning generation, the B'nei HaGola, the second Aliyah, right, the real second Aliyah, so the second Aliyah, B'nei HaGola, was in the time of Ezra, and that was the second group that entered the land of Israel. So there, says the Rambam, v'hichziku b'miksas ha'aretz, they came back and laid claim to a portion of the land. They didn't actually extend to the entire borders that were conquered by the first generation that left Mitzrayim. They conquered a good deal of the land, but it was not the exact same borders. It was miksas of the land. It was a slightly smaller portion. And then he says, kidshuha kedusha shnia, they gave it a second kedusha, ha'omedes li'olam. And this kedusha, the second kedusha, it lasted forever. L'shaisa, for that point in time, ula asid lavo, and for all eternity. And then says the Rambam, v'hinichu osam hamikomos, and there were some places that they actually left untouched. They left them. Places that the first generation, the people who came out of Mitzrayim, they actually had conquered. But the second Aliyah, the second group of Jews who came back to Eretz Israel after the first Galus, after the first exile, there were some lands that they left untouched. They didn't re-establish their sovereignty in those lands. Bechol, Olei Bavel, Kishahayu, Velo Patrum Minatruma Vahamais Ros Kadeshiyismuchu Aleim Aniyim Beshvias. And really, these parts of the land should have been exempt from the laws of Truma and Maaser, because if they didn't reconquer the land, if they didn't settle the land again, so then what happened? The first Kedusha was gone. So if you don't have Kedusha in the land, so then there shouldn't be a requirement to bring Truma and Maaser, because Truma and Maaser is a function of what? It is a function of produce that's grown in the land that has Kedusha. So says the Rambam, these areas, they should have left them, and there should have been no Trumas and Maestros. It happened to be that Midrabanan, they treated those lands. The rabbi said, even though there's really no Kedusha on the level of the Torah, but from the rabbinic standpoint, they treated those lands as if there was Kedusha for purposes of being allowing the produce to be grown there to have the same status of produce of Eretz Yisrael, so that way the poor people would benefit from the various halachos that the poor people were able to collect certain aspects of the produce. So in order to benefit the needy, they required those lands to be treated as if there was Kedusha, but there was no Kedusha. So we have here that there are two conquerings of Eretz Yisrael, and we'll get to your question in a second. I know this is called a lecture, but I don't view myself as being so wise that no one else has anything to add. So I'm going to get to your question in a second, but just let me finish to make sure we have it clear. So there were two times that the Jewish people conquered the land of Israel before 1948. And the first time they conquered the land of Israel, and there were the borders were larger. I actually have the maps here, but we're not going to go through them. The borders were broader the first time. The second time, after that first time, the Kedusha was nullified. The second time they came back, they reconquered the land. The borders were slightly smaller, and they reinvigorated the land with Kedusha, but only the part of the land that they reconquered. The other parts of the land really didn't have Kedusha from the Torah perspective, but the rabbis told you to treat it like it was holy anyway. Are we good? Good. We have a question.
So question number one is, if they were from Olei Bavel, and there were lands that they were off, that there were lands that would abrogate because midrabanan for Trumos and Maestros, then aren't those lands in and of itself settled to accept that Kedusha?
So it's a great question, and we're not going to get into the details of what is considered settling according to halacha. Because there's Kibush Rabim, and there's Kibush Yachid, and there's all various issues that come into play. So it is true that there could have been people living there, but nonetheless, they might not have reached that level of...
unincorporated.
There you go. Okay.
So
the other question. Notice, I'm going to ask some questions too. We haven't gotten to my questions yet, but... If you have it, if we don't answer it, you'll tell us, and you'll ask it later.
Well, just in general, when you say the Kedusha is far as Eretz Yisrael, this is Kedusha in reference specifically to the Mitzvot Tatluyot.
So this is an important point. Yes, from what we're seeing this Rambam, Kedusha has at least, maybe only, but at least one ramification. When we say the land has Kedusha, what does that mean? What is the practical ramification of the fact that the land has Kedusha? So the one way of testing, of using, what barometer can you use to see the Kedusha meter in the land? So you stick the Kedusha meter in the land. If it comes out, yes, Chayiv and Truma and Maaser, etc., so then you know there's Kedusha there. Right, so that's, you know, right now it seems like the Rambam is defining what does it mean to have Kedusha Ha'aretz, to have a land that is Kadosh. It means at least that it requires one's produce to be treated in a specific way. Okay, was there another question before we go on?
How does one lose Kedusha? I mean, how does the land lose its Kedusha?
It's a great question. If you notice the language of the Rambam, he said there, he used two different words from what happened with the generation that left Mitzrayim and the generation that came in from Bavel. So these two different words. The Olei Mitzrayim, they were kovesh, the land. They conquered it. It was a military conquest. The second group, the Olei Bavel, was there a military conquest after the first Gullus? No, there was no military conquest, right? The Jews were let back into the land. They were freely let back in. There was no military conquest. What's the word the Rambam uses? Hechziku. What does the word hechziku mean? Hechziku means to become established, right? So clearly the Rambam understood that when you can relate to the land in different ways. If you relate to the land from a military standpoint, in certain respects, that is a weaker relationship with the land versus an establishment in the land, that it is a function of establishing yourself, your household, your community, your neighborhood, your government, etc., establishing creates an everlasting kedusha, whereas conquest only lasts as long as you are the power in charge. If another power comes in and kicks you out, and the whole kedusha was a function of your power, so now you don't have any power anymore. So that's the short answer. It's not tonight's topic.
Okay, but if you think about it, the partnership of the goyim in kedusha lasi lavo. I mean, kedusha l'shaita and lasi lavo.
Because they allowed us to come in.
They allowed us to come in, so they were mamish, were a sheep, a shutah in that kedusha.
They were a shutuf in the allowance of that kedusha. The kedusha is a function. This is also not tonight's topic. The Rambam was a believer that kedusha is not this heebie-jeebie, mystical, esoteric concept of like there are things that are just kadosh. The Rambam believed that kedusha is a function of human effort and input. So what does the Rambam emphasize? And you see it here. Hechziku, the people, they were established. They were machzik. They developed the land. That's what gave it kedusha. So yes, they had the permission of the non-Jews. The rest of the world gave them permission. But they were the ones that established kedusha, because kedusha doesn't just appear. Kedusha is established. Okay. So this is what we want. So that, now we've got it. It's clear. This is very good. So you have a part. When it comes to the kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, and this is now the kedusha that's still there, right? Because the kedusha that lasts forever is not the original kedusha from Ole Mitzrayim, the larger expanded borders. It's the smaller, slightly smaller. It's only slightly smaller, but the slightly smaller portion that was conquered by the Ole Bavel. Now here's the problem. Look at what the Rambam says in source number two. The Rambam says in source number two, in the halachos of Sanhedrin, right, all the laws dealing with the governing body, the religious halachic governing body of the land of Israel. So he says the following: Ein somchin zakenim b'chutz la'aretz. We know that in order to become a rabbi, what do you have to get?
Smicha.
You have to get smicha. So the rabbis today, I don't want to be motzi laz on any of the rabbis today, but I hate to break it to you, we're all not really rabbis. None of us. There's no such thing as smicha anymore. Hopefully we still know what we're talking about. But the real smicha means that there was a formal, handed down tradition dating back to Moshe Rabbeinu, where there was a formal process of becoming a musmach. And that was a Sanhedrin process. That was something that was very formal and significant. And that process doesn't exist without a Sanhedrin. So Bismana says smicha is really drawing from that process, but it's not the actual process.
According to Rambam does not require a Sanhedrin. He says that the entire...
Well, yes, the Rambam has a very unique shita in terms of smicha. That is definitely not what we're going to be getting to tonight. But here, the Rambam is referring to the process of smicha, which is the formal process, not that I went to YU and took a few bechinas and somebody said, okay, you passed, so therefore you get smicha. This was the formal process of smicha. And that process can only be done, even according to the Rambam, can only be done in Eretz Yisrael. It cannot be done in Chutz La'aretz. That's what the Rambam says. It's from the Gemara. So the Rambam says, "Ein somchin zakenim b'chutz la'aretz v'afal pi she'elu hasomchin nismechu b'Eretz Yisrael." Even if you have someone who got the real smicha in Eretz Yisrael, and then he goes to Chutz La'aretz and he teaches a great Talmud, Gadol Hador, and he wants to give him smicha, you can't do it. You're not physically located in Israel. You can't give smicha. That's the rule. Now, look at these next words in the Rambam: "V'chol Eretz Yisrael shehechziku ba." Ole Mitzrayim Re'uya L'smicha. When you talk about giving smicha to somebody and it has to be done in Israel, how do you define the land of Israel? What are the borders? The original borders from the generation that left Mitzrayim. So wait a second. Is that a little bit puzzling to us? We just saw the Rambam go to great lengths to explain that when it comes to the original borders of the generation from Egypt, that kedusha didn't last. And now comes along the Rambam and says, when it comes to smicha, which can only be done in the land of Israel, well, how do you define the land of Israel? Well, it's based on those old borders, you know, the ones that were nullified and the kedusha left, and now we have new borders. Well, it's based on the old borders. Why does the Rambam think that the smicha, the requirement for smicha that has to be done in Israel, to define Israel, you have the expanded part. You can do it in parts which don't have kedusha, apparently. There are parts that don't have kedusha, and you can still do smicha, so how could it be? What is the Rambam trying to teach us? We'll add on one more question. which is not specifically for the Rambam. There are other discrepancies within the Rambam, but for the sake of time and simplicity, we're just going to focus on this one. They're all really all part of the same group. We'll hopefully get a flavor for it. So the Gemara tells us in Maseches Sanhedrin, Tana Rabbanan, Ein ma'avrin es hashanim ela b'Yehuda. When it comes to the question of creating a leap year in the Jewish calendar, so this is also limited to the land of Israel. In this context, it's talking about specifically in Yehuda, but it's clear that the land of Israel is the place. And if you look in other Gemaras, you don't want to put it all in all in front of you, but the land of Israel is the place where you have to be in order to create a leap year. That's the halacha of the Gemara says. And the question we want to know is, well, wait a second. Do we all have calendars?
But they're wrong. We're not in Adarishon.
Well, apparently the RZC doesn't have a calendar because this is, because apparently 2 weeks ago there was the January year. So that, so apparently the answer might be that we don't have a calendar. But presumably we all have calendars. And the last I checked, right now we're standing in Chicago, in America, not in Israel. And the truth is, we're standing in a leap year. So I don't understand. How do you have a leap year without being in Israel? What is the connection between, right? Is it that leap year is not relevant to us in the exile? Is the calendar different here than anywhere else? Is the calendar only relevant to Jews living in the land of Israel? Why would the calendar be something that is based in the land of Israel? It should be something that's relevant to all Jews across the entire world. So these are the two questions we want to think about. Number one, why would the Rambam tell us that the land has Kedusha based on certain boundaries, the second conquest or the second settlement, but when it comes to smicha, which has to be done on the land, you can do it even in the first boundaries, which lost their Kedusha. And number two, even broader than that, the question of the calendar is specific to the land of Israel, and it's not something that can be done in Chutz Laretz. And the question is why? Why is the calendar something that should be done? It has nothing to do with produce. It has nothing to do with the land. Does the calendar anything to do? You dig in the ground, you find a calendar. It has nothing to do with the land. So why is the calendar specifically dependent on the land of Israel? So those are our two questions. I can't tell if that's a hand. And if it is, I couldn't tell if you were raising a hand. Okay. So now we have to think about these two questions. And for this, we're going to read a passage from Rav Soloveitchik. So Rav Soloveitchik has in some drashos that he delivered to the Mizrahi over the course of many years in his lifetime. They're called the Chamesh Drashot, the five speeches. They've been translated into English, and I have a quote from you from the English version right here in source number 4. The Rav said, "My father of blessed memory explained this by saying that ordination, Egla Arufa, that's another example which we didn't get into the details, but it's another discrepancy where Egla Arufa depends on the borders of the Ole Mitzrayim and not on the borders of the Ole Bavel. So he says that ordination, Egla Arufa, and the sanctification of the new moon are not dependent on the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael, since they have nothing to do with the obligations arising out of territory, but upon not the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael, and this is important, they depend on what the Rav calls Shame Eretz Yisrael, or the name of Eretz Yisrael. So says the Rav, in the name of his father, and by the way, I don't know if this is true, but there's a Mesorah, they say, that when the Rav would say a pshat, if he had a question, he would give an answer. So if he really liked it, he would claim that his father said it, and then he would say the name of his father. So, if he really liked it. The Rav really liked this pshat. It's very well known. The Rav wrote about this in many places, and the Rav used to speak about this a lot. This was something the Rav was very fond of talking about. He says there are two concepts, there are two aspects to the land of Israel. We emphasized one in the beginning, in the Rambam, which was the Kedusha of the land. There's a sanctity in the land, and how is that manifested? That's manifested through the produce. The mitzvos hatzluyos ba'aretz. But then says the Rav, based on the Rambam, there's another aspect to the land of Israel. There's another aspect to the land of Israel, which is called the shame Eretz Yisrael. It is the identity of the land of Israel. It is not dependent on the soil. It's not dependent on the territory. It's not something that is in the ground. It's something that just exists. And we're going to have to figure out what this means, but we'll see what the Rav says. But just this is the concept. So he says, it is true, if you're following along in source number 4, it is true that the first sanctification was rendered for all time, but this only pertains to that which depends upon the sanctity of the land, not to that which depends upon the name Eretz Yisrael, which is never nullified. Says the Rav, the first Kedusha, the first sanctity, yes, it was Batel, but that's only vis-a-vis the actual soil. The part of the Kedusha that relates to the land as a physical entity that manifests itself in Trumos and Masros and the Mitzvot Hatzlius Baretz. So anything that has to do with the Kedusha of the soil, so the first Kedusha was nullified. But there was a second layer of Kedusha. There was a second aspect of Eretz Israel, which was the identification of the land of Israel, and that can never be nullified, says the Rav. That can never be nullified, and that, says the Rav, is the broader borders of the land of Israel. The broader borders of the land of Israel always exist. So says Rav Soloveitchik, hence, these mitzvos may be fulfilled in all areas held by those who came up from Egypt. So what is the Rav saying? The Rav is saying like this. We had a problem, we had a discrepancy that there was Truma and Maaser. In the areas of the land of Israel which were not reconquered by the Olei Bavel, by the second group that came to Israel, if they were not reconquered, there was no Truma and Maaser. But says the Rav, if you want to talk about giving smicha, if you're standing in one of those areas which was not reconquered by the second group, so you can give smicha. Says the Rav, why? Because the Trumos and Maaseros, that has to do with produce. Produce has to do with Kedusha of the soil. But smicha, does that have to do with produce? Does Egel Arufa have to do with produce? Does the calendar have to do with produce, says the Rav? No, it has nothing to do with the land. That has to do with the existence of the state of Israel, the land of Israel, the entity of Israel. That's the shame Eretz Israel, and that exists from time immemorial. And it can never change. So once you have Eretz Israel, the broadest borders, so then those broadest borders are relevant, even if it doesn't create Kedusha in the land, and it won't manifest itself in terms of the produce. It still manifests itself in terms of the ramifications and the impact that it has on Jewish living. And the Rav takes this one step further, and it might be, just bear with us, because you'll see what he means by this as we develop it. The Rav says one step further. If you look in the Chumash, he says you can identify two covenants between the Jewish people and the Ribono Shel Olam. The first, he says, is called Bris Avos. It's the covenant between the Jewish people and the Ribono Shel Olam that took place on the level of our patriarchs, of our forefathers and mothers. And the Pasuk tells us in that context, if you look at source number 5 in Bereishis, the Pasuk says, V'nasati l'cha l'ulazarecha acharecha es eretz migurecha eiz kol eretz kenan. Hashem promises to our forefathers the land of our inheritance. He promises us the land of Israel. L'achuzas olam. It will be for us an inheritance forever. V'hayisi lohem le'lokim. And I will be your God. The relationship between the Jewish people and Hashem as people and God, says the Ribono Shel Olam to the Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, says the Ribono Shel Olam to our forefathers, what is that relationship predicated on? What is it intertwined with? It's intertwined with the land of Israel. The bris between the Ribono Shel Olam and our Avos was that Hashem is our God and we have a land. The two things go hand in hand. You can't have one without the other. But if you look in Sefer Shmos, says the Rav, in source number 8, now if you listen to me and you accept my covenant, you'll be for me a special people, from all the nations, because I am the sovereign of all the world. So what's missing from this relationship between the Ribono Shel Olam and the people? What does he not mention in the context of Har Sinai, which the Rav calls Bris Sinai? What does he not mention? He doesn't mention anything about us having a land of Israel. Because what is Bris Sinai all about, says the Rav? Bris Sinai is about the 613 mitzvos. It's about mitzvos. But he says Bris Avos is much broader than mitzvos. So says the Rav, these two covenants, the bris that took place between the Jewish people and God at Sinai, which has to do with our relationship to Hashem vis-a-vis that we are commanded to do certain mitzvos as our way of serving the Ribono Shel Olam. So says the Rav, you see that the land of Israel is not mentioned in that context. Because the land of Israel has various mitzvos that are associated with it, the same way we have 613 other mitzvos. The land of Israel is another mitzvah. But says the Rav, the covenant between the Ribono Shel Olam and the forefathers, the covenant that serves as the foundation of our identity of who we are as a people, says that goes hand in hand. It's tied with the land of Israel. So says the Rav, these two covenants, they mirror these two concepts that are involved, that are related to the land of Israel. Concept number one is that the land has kedusha, there's soil, it is holy, and that is reflected in the fact that the soil has to, that the produce has to be treated differently. There are mitzvos that are associated with the kedusha of the land. Truma and maaser, etc. That's all about Bris Sinai. That's mitzvos. We all have mitzvos, there are 613 of them. Some of them are related to Eretz Israel, and some of them are not. That's Bris Sinai. But says the Rav, that's Kedusha Sa'aretz, that is the Ole Mitzrayim, that's the Ole Bavel, that is the land, that is the Kedusha Sa'aretz, that is not the shame, Eretz Israel, that is not the identity, that is not the essence of the land of Israel. The essence of the land of Israel goes all the way back to Bris Avos. The essence of the land of Israel is that it is intertwined with the identity and the destiny of who we are as a people. And says the Rav, now we understand perfectly. Now we understand why something like Smicha, like something like the calendar, like something like an Egla Arufa, all the things that the Rambam says have nothing to do with the boundaries of the Ole Bavel, that have nothing to do with the Kedusha and the land, right? All those things, what is Smicha all about? Smicha is about the Mesorah of our people. It is about the destiny, it is about the history, it is about the legacy of our people. What is the calendar about? It's about Jewish life. It is about the essence of who we are. It's about our identity. Those things, says the Rav, yes, they depend on Israel, because without Israel, our identity is lacking. There is something missing. Without the identity, there is something missing. The Hashem said, I'm going to give you a land and I'm going to be your God. Those two things go hand in hand. That's our identity. So when it comes to Smicha, ordaining the next generation of leaders for the Jewish people, that depends on Israel because that's part of our identity, but it has nothing to do with the fact that the land is holy. It has to do with the fact that the land is part of who we are. So says the Rav, that's why it's the borders of Ole Mitzrayim, because it has nothing to do with the Kedusha. Same with the calendar. The calendar is dependent on Israel, not because the Jews in Chutz La'aretz can't tell the difference between January and February for their RZC shears, but because the Jews in Israel are what determines the entire framework of what it means to have a Jewish identity and what it means to live a life of a Jew, which is totally dependent on the calendar. That is something that, even though, yes, of course in Chutz La'aretz, of course outside of Israel, we have to know the calendar and the calendar is relevant to us. But the calendar is not based on us. Jewish life is not based here. Jewish life relates back to the land of Israel. So the calendar is determined in the land of Israel, and from there, it can impact the rest of the world. So says the Rav in source number 7, right? I want to go a step further. We understand full well the connection of mitzvos dependent upon the lands with Eretz Yisrael and with the sanctity of the land, because they are obligations arising out of territory. The produce to which they apply must be produce of sacred ground. That's the kedusha of the lands. That's the Ole Bavel. That's the second part of kedusha. But Egla Arufa, ordination, and the sanctification of the new moon, which have no connection with the territory of Eretz Israel, have nothing to do with the land, and are bound exclusively to the name Eretz Israel, are grounded in the principle that we have explained above, namely, that the Jew outside Eretz Israel lacks the sanctity of the covenant of the patriarchs. It is about what it means to have Jewish destiny, Jewish identity, and to be a Jewish person. And so if this is the case, when we talk about a framework of what the land of Israel can represent, we talk about what is it that the land of Israel can mean for us. So for the Rav, it's not just a place that has Kedusha. Having Kedusha is very important. Having Kedusha, though, it's just like any of the other 613 mitzvos, right? We put on tefillin in the morning, we light Shabbos candles, we have Shabbos meals, we daven, if you live in Israel, you take trumas and maaseros, right? It's another mitzvah. But says the Rav, that's not where it stops. there's a total, completely different aspect, a whole other facet of the land of Israel, which goes beyond just performance of mitzvos. And my Rebbe Rav Michael Rosenzweig, in an article, I think spelled this out very nicely, if you look at source number 8. However, what the Rav characterizes as bris avos, namely that which relates to the history of the Jewish people and the covenant of our forefathers, is something which focuses on the ideal, the ambition of life in Eretz Yisrael. Right? It's not just limited to the mitzvos hatluyos baaretz, the mitzvah of how much truma do you have to take, how much produce do you have to give to the kohen, how much maaser do you have to give. Right? Those are nitty-gritty details. They're opportunities to perform mitzvos, and they're important. But there's a broader ambition. There's a broader sense of identity and legacy that is intertwined with the land of Israel that goes beyond just mitzvah performance. It speaks to the very definition of what it means to live a life of as a Jew. The ambition of life in Eretz Yisrael, the Rav argued that the dinim of Kedushas Karka represent only a small slice of the role that Eretz Yisrael plays in our life. What is more important is the concept of Shem Eretz Yisrael, the concept of the land of Israel. That is to say, the fact that we as a people identify throughout history with the history of our people and with the national headquarters in Eretz Yisrael. That, says the Rav, is what the Rambam is getting at. Those are the two components of the land of Israel. One has to do with mitzvah performance, and the other has to do with Jewish identity and Jewish legacy. And if that's true, that there's a specific framework that the land of Israel provides, it provides the foundation of what it means to live life as a Jew, such that if you don't have the land of Israel, so in Chutz La'aretz, you can't have a calendar, right? It doesn't get more impactful than that. So the ambition, the ideal of Eretz Yisrael, goes much beyond the performance of mitzvos. But we all know that that ideal, while we are very thankful, and we are getting very close to that ideal being fully return to our lands, that ideal is not fully there until we have the final redemption. And I think this is something that Rabbi Eliezer Berkovitz, who maybe some people know from his days here in Chicago at HTC, sorry?
He was the first rabbi in our Torah.
He played rabbi. So anyway, some might be familiar. So he emphasizes, if you look, he wrote an essay, and in the book of Essential Essays on Judaism by Eliezer Berkovitz. So in an essay that was written in 1943, so it was an essay that was written just prior to the development of the state of Israel. So I think he picks up on this extra component that the land of Israel provides, and why developing the state of Israel is such an important step in providing this concept of Shem Eretz Yisrael, the identity of a land of Israel, be it not just about the Kedusha, but about that broader ambition. So he points out, he says, only by the creation of such a Jewish environment can we give back to Torah the great partnership of life, which alone is capable of freeing Judaism from the present exilic rigidity and create the circumstances in which evolution will again be possible. Right? We know that the constant struggle of a Jew, and this is the constant struggle of a Jew in exile, is how do we maintain the authenticity and the integrity of our Torah amidst all the challenges that are around us. And the Torah was so beautifully formulated and created in such a way to help us deal with those concepts. And the process of evolution of Torah and Torah Sheba'al Peh, having an oral tradition in order to address the needs of each and every generation, that is built into the system as part of the process, as part of the antidote for Jews to be able to take the Torah and survive and to keep it alive in all areas and all generations. But says Eliezer Berkovitz that without that central location, without that Shem Eretz Yisrael, he doesn't use that term, but this is what he's referring to, without that sovereignty, that one place which serves as the Jewish headquarters, he says the Torah, to a certain degree, cannot evolve the way it's supposed to. Because without the Sanhedrin, without a central body, without that leadership of the Jewish people, without that pristine environment of what it means to have a Jewish land, so the Torah itself is also in exile, so to speak. And so says Eliezer Berkovitz, that what is so important about establishing the state, and he was a few years prior to the actual establishment, is that establishing the state is providing us already with the beginnings of that framework to bring the Torah into that pristine state where it can actually evolve and continue to grow and to help us really apply it to the generations and to the needs of each and every generation. So that ambition is something that is reflected not just in Jewish life, but in the actual development of the Torah Sheba'al Peh itself, and the Torah itself, and the application of the Torah. And the state of Israel is the first step, right, in terms of that full ultimate fulfillment. And the point that I want to just conclude with is that I personally always feel that whenever we talk about the land of Israel, the state of Israel, and we talk about how amazing it is that it's been developed, there's always that little caveat of, yeah, and we know that not everything is perfect. And we know that we're not fully there yet. And sometimes, and I think that this is exactly the concept that the Rav is developing, the concept of the Shem Eretz Yisrael, the state is exactly that. It is the blossoming of the Shem Eretz Yisrael. That's what the state is all about. And Eliezer Berkowitz is right on target, because it's the first step in really finalizing and bringing us to that ultimate fulfillment, where we will have that complete ambition that we need to survive as a Jewish people. So sometimes I feel to myself, wow, it's so depressing that we always have to throw in that little caveat. But I saw a piece, an excerpt, from a book written by Rabbi Jonathan Sacks called Future Tense, which if you haven't read it, I recommend it. It's a great read. And he points out, not in this context, but I think it's very relevant for us tonight, he points out that that little bit of, we're not fully there yet, which can sometimes be a little bit sad, a little bit debilitating. So the antidote to that is actually built into the land of Israel itself as well. The ambition that we're looking for, and even with that ambition, realizing that we haven't reached the highest ambition that we fully can reach. So that sort of feeling that emotional feeling of emptiness or that hurt that we have because of that, is actually solved by the land of Israel itself. And I want to read with you this passage, and with this we'll conclude. 26 centuries ago, in exile in Babylon, the prophet Ezekiel had the most haunting of all prophetic visions. He saw a valley of dry bones, a heap of skeletons. God asked him, "Son of man, can these bones live?" Ezekiel replied, "God, you alone know." Then the bones came together and grew flesh and skin and began to breathe and live again. Then God said, "Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. They say, 'Our bones are dried up. Our hope is lost. Avdat tikvatenu.' Therefore prophesy and say to them, 'This is what the Lord says. My people, I am going to open your graves and bring you up from them. I will bring you back to the land of Israel.'" And then he goes on to bring the obvious parallel to this vision from Yechezkel. And he says that obviously the Jews in the 20th century, in the Holocaust, we were decimated, and we were left a pile of dry bones. Yet a mere 3 years after standing face to face with the angel of death, the Jewish people, by proclaiming the state of Israel, made a momentous affirmation of life. As if it had heard across the centuries the echo of God's words to Ezekiel, "I will bring you back to the land of Israel." And says Rabbi Sacks, "And a day will come when the story of Israel in modern times will speak not just to Jews, but to all who believe in the power of the human spirit as it reaches out to God, as an everlasting symbol of the victory of life over death, hope over despair. Israel has taken a barren land and made it bloom again. It has taken an ancient language, the Hebrew of the Bible, and made it speak again. It has taken the West's oldest faith and made it young again. It has taken a shattered nation and made it live again. More than a century ago, a young Jew from Lithuania, my great-grandfather, built a house on lands never before cultivated. And the settlers gave it a name from a verse in the book of Hosea, in which God said, 'I will turn the valley of trouble into a gateway of hope.'" Right? Petach Tikva. That remains the Jewish dream. Israel, and I would add, the ambition that Israel, the Shem Eretz Israel, represents, is in and of itself the gateway of hope. That we realize that one day, and one day hopefully very soon in our days, that we will be returned to Israel in its full glory, where we have the Kedusha Eretz Israel and the Shem Eretz Israel in its full ambition as the headquarters for the entire Jewish people, as a symbol for the rest of the world as well. Thank you so much for coming and listening.